This meeting is now being recorded.
Thank you, Jeff. As you can see on the slide in front of you, this is the agenda for today's call. The agenda includes a discussion of the scope of the neonatal abstinence syndrome problem, an overview of the OPQC-NAS project. There will be discussion about addiction as a chronic illness and a description of some helpful resources and some next steps. Next slide, please. The objectives of the webinar are listed here for your review. Please note that the faculty are going to be talking with you about helpful strategies and role behaviors, principally. And our focus is on community hospital staff that support a compassionate approach to NAS treatment. There will be time for open discussion during the call, and as I mentioned, there will be opportunity for you throughout the call to type your questions in so that during the couple of times that the faculty will be answering questions, they'll be right there, and you can get your questions answered as quickly and as many questions answered as possible. Next slide, please. Now I'd like to introduce the faculty for today's call. Dr. Maura Crowley is a neonatologist at Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital in Cleveland, Ohio. She's co-director of the neonatal ECMO program and an assistant professor in pediatrics at University Hospitals Case Medical Center. She is one of the neonatal faculty at OPQC. Scott Wexelblatt is a board-certified pediatrician from Cincinnati Children's Hospital and Medical Center in Cincinnati, Ohio. He's the medical director of their regional newborn services and is an assistant professor of pediatrics at the University of Cincinnati. He's also a neonatal faculty member at OPQC. Michelle Walsh is a neonatologist and is the division chief of neonatology at Rainbow Babies and Children's and at the University Hospitals Case Medical Center in Cleveland, Ohio. She's the lead for the neonatal clinical portion of OPQC. So welcome, Drs. Crowley, Wexelblatt, and Walsh. Now I'd like to turn the webinar over to Drs. Crowley and Wexelblatt. Please, Scott, forgive me. Maura, Scott, next slide, please.
Thanks. So I'm going to do the first portion, and then Dr. Crowley is going to take over and do the second portion. We first wanted to start out and ask all the level one nurseries, who's your go-to person when you're trying, when you get an infant with neonatal abstinence syndrome? Pastoral care, social work, a physician or a nurse that's specially trained, an addiction specialist, or we really don't have one person to, specific person to help us. So we're going to open up the poll now. If everybody could go ahead and answer. We'll track the poll and let you know when we're done. We'll open it for a minute. We already have 33% of the people have voted. And we just reached 50%. We'll open it for 10 more seconds. We're at 65% only. All right, great. So very similar results to what we had when we did the level one seminar earlier in the week. The results were who do we plan to reach out to? 23% first reach out to social services, social worker. 42% reach out to the specially trained physician or nurse on staff. 12% actually have addiction specialists that they can utilize. And 35%, we really don't have one specific person to help us out on this issue. And this is almost the same exact percentage we had. A third of the respondents last week told us the same thing. So this is definitely an area that we're going to try to focus on in future calls. So the next slide is going to show you a little bit about how we think we got to where we are now. In 1995, there was a widely published study that showed cancer patients pain was undertreated. And then at that same year, the American Pain Association issued guidelines on pain management. 4 years later, the U.S. Veterans Affairs Department adopted and spread physician education on this, and then the Joint Commission issued in the year 2000, Take 5, or pain, as the fifth vital sign. And after that time, it seems to be the epidemic of increase in prescription opioids and sort of leads to the opioid epidemic that we're facing now. So this looks at, represents the percentage of clients in treatments with an opioid-related diagnosis when they're admitted, either for heroin or prescription opioids. And this is for all comers, not just pregnant moms. And you can see there's just a small amount of percentage above 6.8% is the number that we're using for the red areas. And then that's in 2001. And as we go to the next slide, you can see this dark area spreads mainly down on the River Lower Corridor in the bottom and up in the northern section of the state in 2005. And then when we get to the next slide, which shows the year 2007, it's still spreading. Next slide shows the year 2009. It's almost the whole area that's part of the state. There's some areas. And then the last slide is 2011. You can see that this is spread throughout the whole state with a percentage of clients with an opioid-related diagnosis in the treatment program. This slide shows you the top left corner. There's three different, really, areas on the slide we want to look at. The top left looks at heroin deaths reported in Cuyahoga County. And you can actually see for the year 2012, there were 71 deaths in Cleveland, and the area around it, it starts to diminish, but seems to be the main area in that central region. The right portion shows the major cities in Ohio, and almost every city is seeing an increase in illicit drug use. And then on the bottom left-hand section, you can see that in the year 2009, unintentional overdose surpassed motor vehicle accidents as a cause of death in Ohio. These are data from the CDC. Top slide shows that there's one death every 3 minutes due to an unintentional opioid overdose. And the bottom slide shows the distribution of states and with infants with neonatal abstinence syndrome diagnosis, and that there's one infant with NAS born every 5 minutes. This study shows that there is looking at the rate of maternal opiate use for 1,000 hospital births. And from the year 2000 to the year 2009, there's been a fivefold increase in maternal opiate use. And then the next slide is going to show you a different, is also from JAMA study, that looks at the incidence of NAS per 1,000 births, and they showed that there's a threefold increase from the year 2000 to the year 2009. One of the issues that we have found, though, that neonatal abstinence syndrome is not a clear-cut opioid problem. This slide, you're going to see this later on, shows that there's a lot of polysubstance abuse with our infants that have neonatal abstinence syndrome, with more than 80% of the infants being exposed to tobacco, and around 50% are exposed to marijuana. And then this also shows that we looked at cotinine levels and by cord analysis on our infants that were treated with neonatal abstinence syndrome. The average U.S. adult smoker's level should be 100 nanograms, but our moms seem to be a little bit more than average smokers, with their average cotinine level being 135, but we've even had the maximum level being 270 nanograms per deciliter. So this tobacco exposure also is a confounding factor when we're trying to treat our infants from opioid withdrawal. Another exposure that our infants are being exposed to is that 10% of these infants are being exposed to SSRIs in utero or benzodiazepines, which also have different type of withdrawal syndromes, which makes neonatal abstinence syndrome not a clear-cut issue to treat. This just shows you the distribution in different cities throughout the state of illegal narcotic abuse, and seems to be distributed differently throughout the state, and that's something that we're looking at with our OCHA study, which I'm going to talk about later, that there does seem to be a lot of regional variation amongst the state. So what are we doing to try to address this increasing incidence and problem of neonatal abstinence syndrome? Well, OPQC has made this one of its projects to look at over the next 18 months. And our aim statement is by increasing identification and instituting compassionate withdrawal treatment for full-term infants born with neonatal abstinence syndrome, we will try to reduce the length of stay by 20% across the participating sites by the June 30th of 2015. This is our key diagram, key driver diagram that we're utilizing to address this problem. You can see our global aim in the top left section shows that our goal is, our aim is to reduce the number of moms and babies with narcotic exposure and to reduce the need for treatment of neonatal abstinence syndrome. And our SMART aim is what we just mentioned. We want to try to decrease the length of stay 20%. The middle section there shows you the main areas that we think need to be addressed to try to work on this problem. And the far right section are the interventions that we want to instill to address each of these main areas. This is our key driver diagram for the level twos and three institutions that we're using. And this next slide is going to show you what we're trying to roll out for our level one nurseries. Very similar with the same global aim and SMART aim, but our middle section and interventions are a little different and more tailored to the level one hospitals. Our goal today is really just to give some background on how we think we got to where we are, give you a little background on what we, how we came up with our protocol and information with our freestanding children's hospital, with our OCHA study, and then future webinars are going to address the interventions on the right and the middle section on their key drivers. So what's the benefit of being in this OPQC collaboration? Well, the most important thing is to learn from what our other colleagues are doing throughout the state. You'll have access to experts in the field of addiction medicine. Learning how to tackle neonatal abstinence through this quality improvement methodology will help you learn how to use QI work and apply it to other projects at your hospital. And the main idea of this is that we all teach and we all learn together. And the best thing about this collaboration is we're going to find out that Hospital X is doing it this way and Hospital Y tried it this way and they couldn't work, and so they start adapting what Hospital X taught them. And really, the whole idea is all teach and all learn from each other. Next slide. So in January of 2012, the six Ohio Children's Hospitals and our affiliates looked at infants that were pharmacologically treated with neonatal abstinence syndrome. We did a longitudinal cohort of these term infants and were able to get the idea of we wanted to try to collect as much information as possible and see what area could we learn from and try to develop a potentially better practice for the treatment of neonatal abstinence syndrome, and to identify variation in our treatment and to see how we could learn from each other. So the next slide, I don't know if it shows you, but the places that we're working with this was Rainbow Babies, Akron, Toledo, Dayton, Columbus, and Cincinnati. So far to date, we have over 800 infants that we've been able to track with neonatal abstinence syndrome. We define neonatal abstinence syndrome only if you require pharmacologic treatment. We are having a paper that's going to be published in Pediatrics in August that looked at our first 547 infants. When we ran this data for the beginning of OPQC, I'm going to give you information on our first 660 infants. So maternal age, average age was 27 years old with a range of 17 up to 44. 92% of our mothers were white, non-Hispanic, and 84% of these moms were single. 80% have public insurance, 10% private insurance, and 10% were uninsured. The good news is that 89% of our moms had at least one prenatal care. Unfortunately, 85 have pregnancy complications, which range from anything from gestational diabetes, hypertension, or any complication. 7% of these moms had STDs during their pregnancy. But one of the most striking numbers that we saw looking at these moms is that 26% of these mothers were hepatitis C positive. So when we do have an infant that has neonatal abstinence syndrome, it's always important to have the obstetric team discuss mom her increased, about hepatitis C and seeing if that needs to be something in her future care. This is going back to our polysubstance exposure, and this is data we got from 80 umbilical cords. We were looking at umbilical cords throughout this study just because, one, it collects data from the infant. It's the same idea of meconium. It looks at the metabolites that accumulate during the pregnancy. So it gives you a good exposure over time. So it goes back to around 20 weeks gestation to the time of delivery. Urine is really only going to give you an exposure window of 4 to 7 days. So umbilical cords and meconium are nice to give you a prolonged exposure history of this infant. We liked umbilical cords because it's much easier to collect than the meconium. It's a one-time deal. What we found is that around 82% of our infants were exposed to tobacco, 50% marijuana, 10% of cocaine, and around 8% to alcohol. And this is just repeating that other slide that we showed previously, that our moms were above average smokers. So looking at our infants, one of the most important things that we found is that the onset of symptoms for withdrawal was 46 hours for our mean. Our median was 38 hours. So it's real important to when you have an opioid-exposed infant to make sure that this is not an early discharge. AAP recommends 4 to 7 days for exposure for observation in the hospital for an opioid-exposed infant. Our region does 72 hours for prescription opioids and 96 hours for buprenorphine or methadone. So really making sure that any opioid-exposed infant is not discharged under 48 hours is the main takeaway that we were able to show. Our average treatment, if we go back a slide, you'll see the average number of opioid-exposed days was 18.5 with a length of stay of 22 days, and that was throughout our whole cohort of 606 infants. The number of drugs used was 1.5. We had 50% of the babies were treated with morphine. Another 49% were treated with methadone. That 1% missing was there's one hospital that's in the study looking at treating the infants with buprenorphine. We do recommend using an opioid to treat it, either morphine or methadone, as a first-line drug. And when we see the number of drugs used, 1.5, our adjuvant therapy in our state has been phenobarbital. Some sites are starting to look at maybe using clonidine as a second set, but right now we are still really only using phenobarbital. So after we came up with this cohort of information, we were able to show the main takeaway was it didn't matter if a center used methadone or morphine to treat the infant. The only thing that mattered on length of stay and opioid exposure was if they actually had a standardized taper on when to at a specific time of when to taper the pharmacologic treatment they were using. So the non-pharmacologic bundle is based on expert opinion throughout the Vaughn network, basically talking about swaddling the infant, using comfort, decrease in external stimuli, using maternal breast milk, or using low-lactose 22-calorie formula. we recommend initiating an increased level of care for Finnegan score greater than 8 two times or greater than 12 one time. Like I said, there was no difference between morphine or methadone. It's just having a standard protocol on when to wean. We escalate the drug once the Finnegan scores go above 12, and we try to stabilize the infant for 48 hours prior to weaning. And then once we do wean, we take 10% of the dosage for the following day, and then we observe the infant 48 hours off drug. So once we came up with this new protocol, then you go to the next slide. You can see we had one of our hospital. The bottom just shows consecutive patients, and the treatment days is on the left. So prior to initiation of this protocol, the average treatment days for this hospital was around 48. After they initiated this new protocol on their next three patients, they dramatically decreased their number of treatment days needed for these infants. So we feel pretty happy with that, our protocol. If you don't have a specific protocol, putting one in place does show to help decrease the length of stay and number of treatment days. I think we went one slide too many. So we're going to – the next three slides are basically going to show what our preview, what's to come. So today we're going to talk about how to improve our non-judgmental support of moms that are addicted, and try to look at this as a chronic disease, that addiction is a chronic disease, and it's, try to do trauma-informed compassionate care. Another thing we're going to address in future webinars is doing scoring. Our level twos and threes, if you go to the next slide, do use Finnegan scoring, but we feel that the Lipset scoring system is a little bit easier to use in a level one setting. So our goal is going to be to train our RN staff to improve inter-user reliability in using this tool. It's 11 subjective measures of withdrawal symptoms, and we're going to be addressing this scoring tool in the next webinar. What we did with the Finnegan scoring is we were able to show that by doing improving inter-user reliability between nursing on this scoring system did show to decrease the length of stay of infant. And then the non-pharmacologic bundle is something that we are going to also address. So is the NIC, questions that people ask, is the NICU better, couplet care, single room or needed for these moms? What we found in our study looking at our 547 infants, that the infants in a level 2 center did the same as the infants in a level 3 center. So these infants don't necessarily need to be transferred out to a level 3 center. If you do have a level 2 center you do work with. Improving soothing techniques have been shown to decrease Finnegan scores. Also talking to moms about their prenatal counseling on what to expect and how they can soothe their baby once the baby's out, and give them ideas on percentages of infants that are exposed to their drug that they're on. And what the outcome of that infant's going to be is very important. We do talk about having mom's milk on demand, and those two explanation points are if she's in a two asterisks are if she's in a maintenance program and her counselor thinks that breastfeeding is okay for her and there's no other illicit substance on her toxicology screen, then mom's milk is definitely best. We do think that a low-lactose formula does work better for these infants, and the higher calorie, using 22 calorie, this is really just during the initial phase of withdrawal when they're needing pharmacologic treatment, when their caloric intake is, their caloric need is higher with a higher metabolic rate due to the withdrawal symptoms that they're experiencing. So I do see that we already have some questions, but we do want to spend some time answering questions that are coming through. We had quite a bit of in the first time, and we have built in a lot of time into this to address questions that we have. So I'm going to let Beth go through the order of the questions, and Dr. Crowley and myself will answer them and give you different, a little bit different regional answers.
Okay, good. The first question is, Do you wean off the adjunct drug first and then use morphine or methadone?
So that's a great question. And it's really different regionally. So some places, a lot of our infants are going home on phenobarbital, and some are trying to wean off on, we use methadone in our region, and it's an 8-step program. Some people are stopping it on the 7th step, which is usually 4 days prior to discharge, and then seeing how that infant does. The problem with phenobarbital is you have to remember there's two issues with it. One, it's in a 13% alcohol solution, and there has been evidence, studies to show that it does cause some apoptosis, some brain cell death with prolonged exposure. So we really don't want to do any adjuvant therapy, and the less drug they're on is the better. And I'll let Dr. Crowley tell you what they do because they use morphine in their region.
Yeah, so we use morphine, and use phenobarbital as an adjuvant therapy. I have to say, before we really adopted the Ohio protocol, we were using a lot more phenobarbital than we are currently. But we usually would have sent these babies, we would wean off the morphine and continue the phenobarbital and send these babies home on a phenobarbital taper over another week or two. But, you know, like a lot of this is, you know, kind of experience and not necessarily very evidence-based, and so I'm not sure that there's a true right or wrong answer as to what to wean first. But I can say that after adopting the new protocol that we're using a lot less phenobarbital.
That's great. Thank you. You know, Jeff, I'm going to need your help. I'm not able to open up the raised hands, and we do have two other questions.
The raised hands actually went down, but if those people do still have questions, go ahead and type them in the chat box. But from Helen McGoyle, for a baby exposed to heroin, methadone, Subutex, how soon after birth would you recommend the baby be transferred from a level one facility?
So I think introducing the non-pharmacologic bundle, which we're going to get to, and instituting the scoring system that we're going to get to on the next webinar, not every baby that is exposed is going to have withdrawal. I think the data is really showing about 60% will have significant withdrawal that may need pharmacologic treatment. So the withdrawal signs and symptoms are not going to show up usually. The average we found was 46 hours. And so it's really how comfortable your hospital feels and how comfortable the family practitioner or pediatrician caring for this infant feels with this infant. So our goal is to try to keep the baby with the mother as long as possible. And so I think you have to do it on an individual hospital basis and individual looking at each mom and what their exposure was and what their follow-up is going to be. So that would be my answer, but Dr. Crowley may give you a different one.
No, I think that it's true. Every baby and situation is going to be different, and, you know, one baby who is exposed, or two babies who are exposed to the same, you know, drug prenatally, like, you know, such as Subutex, one baby may have withdrawal symptoms while the other one doesn't. And so I think it's, you know, but once you're getting to the point of thinking about medically treating with, you know, opiate replacement, that's maybe a time to think about transferring the baby. And I think we'll, with the coming up sessions, we'll you know, kind of better explain all of this in a more formal setting, too.
That's great. Are there other questions, Jess? I'm not seeing any.
I'm not seeing any either. I think we're good to go.
Okay, good. Thank you. Dr.
Well, actually, one just came in real quick.
Oh, okay.
From Stephanie McConnell. I'm from a level 3 and we use methadone. Do you see a large difference in weaning from morphine versus methadone?
So our study that's going to be published like in Pediatrics next month is going to show you that there was no difference in the length of stay or the opiate number of days that the infant needed treatment between morphine or methadone as long as the institution is using one drug and there's a protocol on a specific time and number on when to treat, when to go through this process of the weaning, the weaning process of the drug. So we use methadone in our region, and we have a set time. If the scores are between 8 and 12, you maintain. Below 8, you go to the next level. And then that's the same protocol, except morphine-based, is that you drop 10% when you're weaning once your scores are below 8, also in the Finnegan score. So in having a set protocol and using one protocol at each hospital has been shown to be the difference, not the drug of choice.
Terrific. Thank you. Next slide, please.
So I'm going to talk about understanding addiction as a chronic illness. And I just want to acknowledge that these slides actually came from Krasana Deppen, who is a family medicine addiction medicine specialist who does do a lot of work with moms who are addicted and helping them in their through their pregnancy. And unfortunately, she could not join us on the call, so I'm going to try to do her slides justice. So we're going to start this session like we did the last section with a poll of the audience. And so we want to know, to what extent do you feel an individual is personally responsible for their addiction problem? Not at all, moderately responsible, or very responsible? And we'll keep this poll open for a few minutes until we have the majority of responders. See, we have, I think we have most of our responses, so we can probably close it. And so about 56% feel that these individuals are moderately responsible, and about 44% feel that these individuals are very responsible. And so I think, you know, this is a very common theme amongst medical personnel, and part of the goal of this statewide collaborative is for us as a medical community who are involved with these families to improve our care, not only for the babies, but also of the mothers, and become more compassionate and non-judgmental in our care, and hopefully promote a better long-term outcome for both the infant and the mother. So we'll go to the next slide. So this part of the talk, we're going to do Substance Use 101 Mythbusters. So in an effort to understand addiction, we will discuss a lot of common misconceptions about addiction and hopefully shed some light. So addiction really has not been portrayed in the media in a very positive light. It's been, as a lot of these headlines you can see, stir up a very negative, you know, guttural feeling about, you know, the smallest babies are the sufferers. This baby, you know, inherited their daddy's eyes, but their mother's heroin addiction. And so it really puts us in a negative mind frame for these poor mothers. Next slide. So a common myth is that if these mothers really cared about their babies, they would just quit. And it's important to know that those who can quit often do. Addiction has multiple effects on the brain, and it's similar to other chronic medical illnesses. We go to the next slide. So addiction is a primary chronic neurobiologic disease with genetic, psychosocial, and environmental factors that influence its development and manifestations. So the neurobiology of addiction, there is a known role of dopamine, and it encompasses more than just neurochemistry of reward. And it's been shown or known that the frontal cortex is altered, impulse control, altered judgment, and the dysfunctional pursuit of rewards is all part of the neurobiology of addiction. Next slide. So when we look at relapse rates with addiction, it's actually very similar to relapse rates in other chronic illnesses. So as you can see from this study, so drug addiction relapse rates about 60%. Relapse rates for type 1 diabetes is anywhere from 30 to 50%. And for hypertension, it's 50 to 70%, and asthma as well, 50 to 70%. So it's, you know, it's a disease process that has addiction rates to, that are similar to many of the other illnesses that we deal with. Next slide. Another common myth is methadone or buprenorphine is just another addiction. It's important to know that dependence is different than addiction. It's methadone or buprenorphine is legal, safe, and it's monitored. And actually, studies show improved outcomes when for patients that are on methadone. Next slide. So looking at dependence that, you know, is different than addiction. So a physical dependence, you can have tolerance and withdrawal can develop with appropriate use of prescription medications, whether they be pain medications or addiction treatment medications. And in contrast to that, is addiction is characterized by behaviors that include one or more of the following. So impaired control over drug use, continued use despite its harm, and craving, so what they call the three C's. Slide. So opiate maintenance therapy, specifically talking about methadone, actually began in 1967 by Dole and Niswander, and it's been shown to have improved outcomes with decreased mortality, reduced illicit drug use, reduced seroconversion of HIV to AIDS, decreased criminal activity, and increased socially productive activities. Only 10 to 20% of patients who discontinue their maintenance therapy are actually able to remain abstinent. And PET scans actually suggest that methadone maintenance at least partly normalizes cerebral glucose metabolism as compared to patients that withdrawn from methadone in sustained remission. Next slide. So another common myth is maintenance therapy is helpful for mom, but it really can't be good for the baby. However, we know that maintenance therapy improves maternal outcomes. I think if you click it again on the slide, there's improved obstetrical outcomes, and both the improved maternal outcomes and obstetrical outcomes actually help with improved neonatal outcomes. So the maternal improvements that we know of, there is decreased risk of relapse. There is improved prenatal care. There's higher likelihood of abstinence from concomitant drug use. And we know from what Dr. Wexelblad had presented earlier that a lot of the babies that we have taken care of in Ohio have multiple other exposures. And untreated heroin use in pregnancy is linked to several adverse outcomes, including growth restriction, placental abruption, fetal demise, and preterm labor. So methadone use has also fetal improvements where we have higher birth weights and babies are born at higher gestational ages. Another common myth is that these moms are just so much work, it really isn't worth it. However, improving the care of these families is valuable to the infant's long-term care and development. Improving care is valuable to the substance-using family. Improving care may be valuable to your staff and could be valuable to you. So if we improve our care to these families, they're probably more likely to seek help from the system, and we can improve the long-term outcomes of the family. So benefits from improved care for the infants and families. So the infants, so after delivery, the long-term outcomes are improved with a safe, sober environment to grow up in. And it's facilitated by early bonding, so keeping mom and baby together. And the mothers and families, so recovery from addiction can be life-changing. Recovery occurs at similar rates to treatment of many other chronic medical diseases. And delivery of infants affected by drug use could be a teachable moment. So we have a lot of opportunities to affect both mom and baby with our compassionate care. So the importance to medical providers. So providing substance using families a different experience of healthcare system may help facilitate better bonding and care for their infants. Creating an environment where the moms are welcome can create a better environment for us to work in. And understanding addiction and learning skills to communicate effectively with these families could lessen caregiver burnout and stress. So how can we start to engage our mothers? So there's things called motivational interviewing, which is a collaborative, person-centered from guiding to elicit and strengthen motivation for change. It has five components, and one is to express empathy, develop discrepancy, support self-efficacy, role with resistance, and eliciting change talk and commitment language. So in conclusion, you know, wanted to leave you with the fact that addiction is a chronic and treatable disease. Opiate maintenance therapy with methadone or buprenorphine may play an important role in treatment of pregnant women struggling with addiction. Opiate maintenance therapy improves the outcomes for both pregnant women and their families, and providing non-judgmental, compassionate care can be rewarding and beneficial to the patients and the providers. So I think we'll open it up for questions at this time. Can either type them into the chat box or raise your hand.
We have one question asking, will we have access to the recorded webinar to share with other team members? And the answer to that is yes. It will be posted on the OPQC.net website after today. The OPQC program management staff will have that posted so that your other colleagues can enjoy that. Are there other questions? Again, you can see that I'm not an expert at this, so I'm going to ask my friend Jess. Do you see any additional questions? Oops, I think I do see one. How does methadone treatment decrease HIV seroconversion?
That is a very good question. I think it's that if you're using less, if you're on methadone as a treatment, there would be probably less intravenous drug use and mm-hmm. decreased rates of HIV and AIDS.
So you're saying by decreasing the use of IV drugs, that would decrease the seroconversion?
Yes. That would.
Okay. There's another question. Will the slides be available as well? Yes, ma'am, they will. Any other questions? While you've got the contact expert here. Okay, next slide, please. I want to thank Maura and Scott and all who participated in today's discussion. I think that this webinar has been a powerful reminder of the relationship between knowledge and medical treatment, as well as compassionate approaches to care with addicted mothers and their babies for optimal outcomes with NAS. Our next steps, which both Drs. Wexelblatt and Crowley alluded to, is you can ignore that first bullet point, of course. This is part one of three webinars that will address the NAS issue in the state of Ohio and nationally. The second webinar will be in the early fall. You'll receive information about it via registration and a newsletter. And the topic of that second webinar will be the identification of women who use narcotics. How do you screen? What are good approaches to drug testing? Legal issues, the duty to report. As Dr. Wexler mentioned, we'll be talking about the lipstick scoring tool for newborns. And then the question, what is it safe to discharge? All the issues that surround that. The third webinar will also be in the fall, probably the mid-fall, and we'll be talking about non-pharmacologic care of NAS. How do you optimize that? And then how do you know who needs to be referred for treatment and who can be safely cared for in a community hospital? So we hope that you'll be able to join us for that. Next slide, please. Here are some resources you may find helpful. As I mentioned, the OPQC.net is the address for the OPQC website. Some of you have been participants in other OPQC projects, and you do have access to the members section of OPQC. We want you to know that the slides and the recording will be in the non-member section, in other words, the publicly available section. So it would be open to anyone who wanted to see and hear it. If you have other questions that weren't answered, please feel free to use our email, opqc@cchmc.org, and we will get those questions to the appropriate person so you can get an answer. And our Twitter account is @OhioPQC, and almost every single day something is posted there, and they're kind of interesting things. I enjoy looking at the Twitter account every day. Next slide. That might be my last slide. I want to thank you very much for the time that you spent with us today, and look forward to continuing our discussion with you in future webinars. Thank you for your time and interest. Goodbye.